Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for subscribing, liking, sharing, following, and posting those 5-star reviews. We really appreciate it, and hope you like today's episode.
Yeah, thank you guys. If it's your first time listening, we're glad you found us. We know you're going to enjoy it. After you enjoy it, do all those things Phil said. Go follow us on any social media platform, Instagram, whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on. Follow us and give us a review. Tell us how awesome we are, because we need constant positive reinforcement.
This is true. Otherwise, we just stop.
Right.
No. I think this was my worst intro ever. I don't know. I got like tongue-tied.
Phil's got stuff in his throat. Yeah, it's one of those days. It's cloudy out.
But hey, you guys are with us, and we're stoked about it. So today's guest, we've got another author with us. I saw he has published at least 3 books, and one of them just came out last week. So I saw that he was a Coast Guard veteran. I love it when guys write about the service, because it gives us a chance to go back and hear their stories and see how nothing's ever changed, despite how many people are forward-thinking and think they have the answers. It seems like most things stay the same.
New acronyms and different toys, but same old stuff, right?
Love it, though. Love it. Who wants to change it?
Right.
So today's guest, who we got on the line, Mr. Mark Holmes, born and raised in Danbury, Connecticut, joined the Coast Guard back in February of 1971 with Recruit Company Victor 1-4 out of Cape May, New Jersey. Went from there to Radioman School, another Radioman. He's in good company, I think, on this podcast. Once he graduated, first cut orders to the Coast Guard cutter Courageous, and then to the radio station in Miami. Bill and I thought that was kind of comical. I've never heard it called radio station Miami. We've got all these fancy names for what is essentially a radio station.
Right.
And then worked on some weather buoys near the end of that tour. Did another tour at the Amber Center on Governor's Island in New York. And in February of 79, got out with an honorable discharge to pursue other avenues. So I'm stoked, because any guy that can fill an entire book with sea stories is going to be a good guest.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm always happy when we've got a 210 sailor on board. So
yeah, I know. Yeah. You know, right. We had to hear about it for like 10 minutes about how great the 210 is. It's, or actually how terrible it is.
It's all those things. Like everything else in the Coast Guard, it's all those things. All right, we'll stop rambling on. Mark, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. And with that, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Well, thank you for having me aboard, and it's a pleasure. As you know, the 210 rides beautifully, much to the dismay of some of those of you who might detract from it. But anyway, I was on a 210, the Courageous, out of Port Everglades. Not Port Everglades, Port Canaveral, right near Cape Canaveral, right near the sub base, in fact.
I can't believe you talked about Cape Canaveral and you mentioned the sub base, but not the space shuttle launch pad.
Well, you know,
space shuttles weren't a thing when Mark was on the Courageous.
Weren't they?
No, it was the Apollo.
No, it was still Apollo.
Yeah.
Apollo 13 or something, one of those. But, I was just on board for a couple of months. Most of the time we had been on search and rescue and patrol. But we were in port, kind of a well-deserved rest, on December 23rd, 1971. I had quartermaster of the watch duty, of course, standing next to the noisy air return, with a telephone and a gangway, and nobody really around because it's, you know, December 23rd. Well, we get a call from the rescue center in Miami. They've got a 26-foot disabled sailboat off of Fort Pierce, which was maybe, you know, a few hours south of Port Canaveral. Dismasted, there's three people on board. We need to get out there now. So, I don't know if you guys use Bravo status anymore, but
absolutely.
Pretty much it means you got to be within like 1 hour and ready to go. So, and the weather was just horrible. So I started calling back the crew, and as soon as we had enough guys back, off we went. But before we left, four Navy minesweepers pulled in the port and tied up along the sub base near us. And they, you know, they came by to let go our lines, and they said, "You guys are going out there. You got to be nuts."
Yeah, I like it. Good.
Yeah, it was too rough for them, and it was indeed quite rough. We got to the sea buoy, and everything just started to fall apart. I mean, it was bad. I think we were probably looking at 25-foot seas all the way down.
Hey, Mark, in the minesweepers' defense, they do hunt mines for a living. Somebody's got to just point that out.
Well, in their defense, they're in the Navy.
Also true.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think there was too many mines in the Gulf Stream.
Fair enough.
So anyway, they came in for a break, and they just kind of said, "Off you go, have a nice time." So we headed down. I think I had the first radio watch. We just had a skeleton crew. As soon as we had enough, off we went. And it took, you know, a number of hours to get to the sailboat, and, you know, I'm surprised we were even able to find it, quite frankly.
I'm guessing you guys were making a whopping 8 or 10 knots against the Gulf Stream. I've done that transit in calm seas, and the 210 barely pushes against the Gulf Stream.
Well, I think it's rated for like 18, but I don't know. I was in the rear room trying not to get thrown into the wall, wrapped into the seat. I'm sorry, did I say wall? I meant whatever you guys call it.
Oh, get out of here. Come on, now you have to say it. All right, bucket.
Yeah. No, I mean, I had to strap myself in. It was just wild. So I finished my watch, and as we were pulling up to the sailboat, you know, the blue lights flashing, they must have felt quite relieved, I imagine. And, you know, the captain's trying to keep them on our lee side. But it was hopeless. I mean, they're going 15 feet up, or we're going 15 feet up, just back and forth. The man, they put me on the bridge wing, not the bridge wing, the flying bridge watch after my radio. And, you know, on a 210, that's the highest point where you can stand, and I'm hanging on for dear life. The XO's yelling at me not to lose sight of them. And the deck crew's on the stern trying to get a line to them. And the lady is standing in the front of the bow of her sailboat, and the man is just kind of like laying back by the in the little cockpit. And everybody's wondering what's going on with him. Well, it turns out he had broken ribs. Mm. And they had lost his mother-in-law over the side already. It was just horrible. So the lady couldn't figure out what to do with the lead line. She kept trying to tie that off, and of course it kept snapping. And the guys are screaming at her, no, you got to pull in the main line. So finally they figured that out, and we're just getting beat up. I mean, it's just up back and forth. There's no way we could have even gotten them on board. But finally she secures the line, and we begin a very slow tow, just making headway barely towards Fort Pierce to try to get them in. Captain decides, no way, this is not going to happen. This boat's going to go down. So we get a big old helo out there from St. Pete, one of the old HH-50 no, not 52, the 3F, the big one.
You got me.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I think it is
HH-52. They call it a Sea King or something. Mm-hmm. It's a huge one. So they hustle out and they airlift these folks off the sailboat, which includes a baby, by the way. The name of the boat is Ian's Cradle. It's got like an infant on board, and the poor kid is strapped inside the cabin. So anyway, they lift these folks up, and about 10 minutes later, that boat takes a nosedive and doesn't come back up.
Ian's Cradle to the Cradle of the Deep. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, this is a boat designed for, you know, like intercoastal waterways. It wasn't designed. They were trying to go to the Bahamas for Christmas.
Right.
Right. Which is a short, easy trip on a nice day.
That's crazy.
But you wouldn't take that particular boat across to the Bahamas, I'm sorry. Right. Anyway, you know, they get saved. I don't know whatever happens to them. I hope they're all well still. But that boat takes a nosedive, and that's it. We cut it off and head back. And on the way back, a bunch of our 3-inch ammunition breaks loose in the ammo locker, which is right next to Ops Berthing, by the way.
Yep.
We get a call. I'm up on the bridge hanging out. We get a call from Dawson's mate down in the locker. And he's screaming, "Stop the ship! Stop the ship!" We all rush down there, and the guy, poor guy, sitting on the deck. He's got 3 of these shells wrapped up in his arms, and there's 2 or 3 others just rolling back and forth, smashing up against the bulkhead. After we stopped laughing, we helped him up. And, boy, we got beat up on the way back. Lockers were falling over. The antenna wires were gone. It was just a mess.
Was it like a tropical storm that came through, or what was it?
No, it was just a winter storm.
One of those days.
So we get back. It's Christmas Eve. We tie back up at the sub base. Just the most desolate-looking thing you'd ever want to see. I guess our regular pier was under repair. The minesweepers had gone back out. They found their sea legs, I guess. And so there it is, Christmas Eve, and guess who's got the quartermaster of the watch again?
Man, you're in zero luck.
Merry Christmas.
For Christmas. I think I'd probably stayed in for somebody, you know, a married guy or whatever. Talk about a lonely Christmas, first year away from home.
What was the going rate to take somebody's holiday watch in the 70s?
I didn't take any money. We just swapped. We just swapped around. What's it going right these days?
I think you'd be looking at 3 digits in this day and age for somebody to take that watch.
Yeah. There's a Benjamin.
Mm-hmm. Or 3.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, of course, we don't condone that, and it never happened. My non-rates never did that.
That never happens. No. Yeah. No. So anybody who was married pretty much got off the boat, and the guys who were single and were not on duty were at a bar, and Merry Christmas, 1971. I was just so happy that we kind of lived through it and that these folks lived through it, too. That was the best part.
Yeah, especially with the boat sinking right after you guys were able to get them off.
Right.
And oh, my God.
All the good stories, have you ever noticed, like, all our really good stories, it's always early in people's career.
Yeah.
Like, always. First unit, second unit.
Yeah. I was in, 10 months, and I had the adventure of my life.
Right.
So,
it's one of those days you learn what secured for sea really means.
Really?
Good point. Solid point right there.
Well, yeah, and stuff that was tied down didn't matter. It got thrown loose.
Yeah.
I think we lost our helo nuts, long wire antennas. Kind of like when we got hit by a tornado.
You got hit by a tornado on the boat?
Yeah. First we got hit by a water spout.
I don't think people get hit by water spouts. I think we all intentionally drive through water spouts just to see what's going to happen.
I mean, that's probably fair.
I've done it.
Yeah. Was the BM1 driving? Then he probably definitely went through it on purpose.
I think it was a BM1 one. But it was awesome. That's all I can tell you. It's awesome.
It was pretty early for quite a bit, and it messed up the helo nuts and a few other things. But then a couple months later, there was a... this was June, I think, 72. There was a way off of Tampa, the other side of the state. But, you know, these things spawn tornadoes. And the good old Courageous was tied up in part. We had just finished painting it out.
Of course.
It was beautiful. It was gorgeous. This tornado comes in, takes a direct hit, and breaks all the mooring lines. They had to chop the power cable, and guys just jumped into action. You know, they got get lit off the engines. I don't know if you've ever been down to Port Canaveral, but the channel is like maybe 500 feet wide. It's not big at all. So they saved it, got everything going, tied it up at another dock, and we found gravel embedded into the aluminum superstructure. Oh, the long wires were gone. Like one of the VHF antennas was all twisted. It was just a mess. Windows broken. Yeah, so I attract tornadoes.
So Dark Force had to start repainting. That's what I heard.
Yeah, we had to repaint it.
Right.
Well, yeah, we
Mark's like, not my problem.
Yeah, we came up with a really long search and rescue. We were way off of Charleston somewhere, way out in the ocean, deep water, and came back, stopped in Charleston, and they got word the admiral of the district was going to come by for a visit. So all liberties canceled. We need to paint over the rust and make it look good. And he blew us off.
Of course.
Yeah, of course.
You did that Navy paint job. Yeah. One for dust, two for rust.
Exactly. And then, of course, you know, you get back to Canaveral. It's time to scrape it all down again.
Right.
Old radio man, there's not much for us to do in port, so we become deckhands.
Rightfully so.
Huh.
Rightfully so. I've handled a needle gun, so there.
All right. That's awesome, man. I will say that in my experience, the rates that have been your successors are not as involved in that kind of thing.
I didn't say that.
I said it.
Okay.
I didn't call out a rate either.
No.
In today's Coast Guard.
Yeah, in today's Coast Guard, I have not had that experience that some of the successor rates to the radiomen pick up a needle gun very often, if at all.
Yeah, I've done that. I've gotten splashed in the eye with that blue paint, not thinner, what
like anti-foul?
Yeah.
Oh, the copper, the green? Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Mark, I'm just curious. So you joined in February 71. What did they used to tell people to get them to join the Coast Guard? Like, what was the recruiting slogan back in 71?
I have a guess.
You know, I didn't hear one. I was, when I was a kid, I had kind of an affinity for the Coast Guard. We would go on vacation up in Maine, and I'd see these 40-footers and 44-footers at the ready on the dock in Rockland, and I'm thinking, man, those are cool. And then one time we saw a tall coastie with his Donald Duck hat and his breast blue standing by the corner of the highway as you enter Maine and waiting for a ride, and I'm thinking, I want to be that guy. And then when the opportunity came, which was when we had the draft.
That's right.
I was going to say, was the sales pitch, you probably won't have to go to Vietnam.
Yep.
Well, and that, you know, big sales pitch, because I think more guys went per capita to Vietnam than any other service.
Right.
And everybody in my radio class after me, I finished fourth. Everybody after me got the choice of taking a 378. And they all, I think, ended up over in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Did they really? But every 378 went over there?
There was only like four of them at the time, I think. But yeah, they used them for offshore gunnery support.
Yeah, I remember like that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the older ones were over there too. The Androscoggin was there, and the Alaska, a bunch of them.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so in New York we had the Dallas and the Morgenthau, I think, and there may have been a couple more. And so some of these guys had a short walk to their next duty station, and most of them went over there.
And what happened to the Courageous, Mark, like after her service?
Well, you know, the Courageous was kind of a bad luck or hard luck cutter. I think it was built in 65, I think. I got a picture of it, of its launching in front of me. But problems with the drive shafts, I guess, or the propeller shafts and the engines. It just got to be too much. And they decommissioned it, I think, in 2001 and sold it to or gave it to the Sri Lankan Navy. And those folks still use it, painted it gray, and, you know, God bless them.
Hey, we're still floating 14 of them in the Coast Guard, too, so.
Are there 14 of them?
I believe there's 14, yeah.
You're good at this random cutter knowledge.
Yeah.
You're saying there's 14 210s still left?
Yeah.
No kidding.
I think they've only decommed two of them.
Did we ever share a rule for award writing?
No, you should.
Did you ever have to write an award, Mark?
Did I ever have to write an award?
Yeah, like when you were in the service, like did you ever have to like write somebody an award or a page 7 or anything?
No, mostly I was more on the discipline side.
Yeah, fair enough. Most are.
At the Amber Center, you know, we're getting all these messages in from merchant ships around the world. And they got to be coded into a computer format.
What is Amber? What's Amber stand for?
Automated Mutual Assistance Vessel Rescue, and it's a system that's still in operation today. Of course, it's all using GPS and all that. But back then, we were triangulating their positions on the computer. And so if you didn't code these things properly, I mean, we would get the messages in. Radio men like me would take the messages and forward them to New York. We'd get it on a teletype and sit there with a big chart. And you guys still know what charts are, right?
Yeah. Barely, though. Maybe not for long.
You ever heard Loran?
You haven't listened to all the old episodes. Bill actually, for a long time, carried an interpolator in his wallet.
So, precise and plotting these courses for the merchant ships. And I'm up to Central Park, and I'm going to hang you from the highest tree if you don't straighten out. And I guess I would be brought up on charges today if I said that, but, you know, he came around pretty good.
I've said worse.
All right. Were you a company commander in boot camp?
No, absolutely not. Just a BM-1 on a 210.
Oh, no. Yeah, we had some real characters. Well, if anybody
gets sensitive, Bill.
Yeah.
In my book goes through quite a bit of those characters and what we got away with or the fun we enjoyed.
Let's hear it. Give us your favorite story from the book. Don't even have to finish it, Mark. You get like that.
Yeah, we want people to go buy the book,
it, right? Give us your favorite one.
Well, you know, the Eanes Cradle was something I wrote up about 25 years ago intending to do something with it, and that was really the genesis of doing the whole book.
Which is very cool, man, because if you think about it, like you're, you know, young man just out of A school, hadn't been on the cutter that long, and then immediately, you know, saving lives, and it had that kind of impact to make you write a book.
And thought to write it down.
This far after the fact.
It was pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the fun things we did was we traded our 3-inch gun mount with one that belonged to the Miami Beach VFW.
Because, of course, the VFW has a 3-inch gun mount.
They had a 3-inch gun mount that was in working condition on the front lawn, and ours broke. I guess it wasn't really an orderable item. You know, these things are pretty old. So they found one down in Miami Beach that belonged to the VFW, and apparently was in working condition, so we puttered our way down there. On this particular trip, a few of us brought our motorcycles tied to the fantail. And they pulled off the broken 3-inch and brought in the one from the VFW and put all the parts they needed, you know, whatever. You guys probably know better than me, you know, all the working mechanisms. And we had ourselves a working gun.
I'm just imagining, like, who was at the VFW, like, in there drinking and came out and was like, that thing looks like it works.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 theme storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
We don't have any around.
I'm just thinking that things really do never change.
That's a little different. I mean,
I don't know.
We replaced the gun mount on Vigorous, and it was definitely a more like we had to order it from the Navy and schedule it with the Navy and
you
blah,
actually
blah,
had to
blah.
Do like a live fire and make sure the stops were good. And
no, well, it wasn't the gun. It was just the mount.
Just the mount.
Yeah.
Yeah, but once you get the gun mount.
This was the whole gun.
Yeah.
I think I went through on that one.
That's unreal. It doesn't surprise me, though, with the Miami VFW.
It doesn't surprise me at any VFW. They all still have probably a working 3-inch gun out front. Because it's probably some dude at the VFW who services it.
Yeah, another fun little event was when we went to underway training up in Norfolk, I guess, with the Navy. They found a couple of old scows for us to participate with. On the way up, we either hit a whale or the whale hit us, because the whole cutter just shook. I was up on hanging out on the bridge wing, and we just shook like somebody had punched us. And I look aft, and there's a big tail, a huge tail, disappearing underneath the waves. I said, we just got hit by a whale.
I think I know why your propeller shafts weren't aligned
that
anymore.
That could have been it. And they could never get over. They could never get past it.
Were you the one that sighted the tail? Like, did you have to report it down to the old man?
Oh, I don't know. There was a couple of us on the bridge wing. I presume the quartermaster made a log entry.
Yeah.
That was wild. But, you know, we smoked the Navy, of course. They were just virtually helpless. We scored 100% in the radio, I know that. And I think the damage control team did as well. The comments were from the shipwriters where it's the finest, by far the finest damage control team they had seen. These guys were good. And the Navy couldn't even start their P-250 pump. We had to help them with that.
Again, things never change.
Yeah.
On Morse code, we were still using Morse code, of course. We would typically send 25, 30 words a minute. The best they could do on the Navy was 6. It was so difficult to send that slow. We almost couldn't do it. So we pretty much swapped. We got an O rating, which, there was no provision to put an O on the side of the superstructure, just an E. But we were in the O, and as we left harbor, there was a Navy jet that was buzzing us back and forth. I think somebody had put a broom up on one of the yardarms for the clean sweep. And they kept buzzing us until Gunner's Mate Johnny started tracking them with the 3-inch. And then they left.
Only in the 70s. Yeah, that wouldn't happen now. That would get you in trouble.
Yeah.
Half of what's in my book, I'm sure we would have been brought up on charges. So.
Well, it took you a few decades to even write about it. So I'm assuming, right. You had to let the grace period pass, right?
Check the statute of limitations.
Yeah, I had some help remembering some of these little details in contact with some of my old buddies on Facebook. And there's one guy locally as well.
Bill doesn't know on Facebook still.
Yeah, I'm not a Facebook guy.
So it was kind of a bucket list thing. And I actually, by that time in my work life, I had time to do it. So yeah, it was a fun exercise, and I get royalty checks every month, so that's good.
That's a fun exercise.
Yeah, you can't beat that one. What was your last case on the Courageous? Or what else did you guys do in the 70s? I guess really, like when you were underway, what was the primary purpose of the patrols, and where'd you guys go?
Well, we only had like 2 or 3 week patrols back then. you know, once the milk ran out, we started getting nervous. Two or three weeks was all we were doing. It was in the Gulf Stream, pretty much, KSL Banks. We weren't much into law enforcement at that point. I think we didn't really know what to do at that point. At one time, I think the captain had us send a small boat over to look at a couple of fishing boats that were within sight of the 7 mile bridge along the Keys.
Okay.
So it wasn't that intent. It was more search and rescue. So we were from Key West, which was a very unique Liberty port.
Well, some things haven't changed.
Yeah, but often as not, we'd get a search and rescue call while we're on patrol, or usually as we're approaching the sea buoy to come back from.
Right, yeah, always.
Boats would become disabled in the Gulf Stream, and they would just start drifting north for 3 or 4 knots, and we'd chase them and end up off South Carolina somewhere, or Georgia. Sometimes we'd find them, sometimes not. We usually found other people disabled along the way, lobster boats, other fishing boats.
So now a question for you, Mark. You said your typical patrol was 2 or 3 weeks. Then was that like 2 or 3 weeks in port and then back out after 2 or 3 weeks? Or?
Yeah, more or less. We'd have regular patrols, but it all kind of ran together because we'd get a lot of search and rescues.
Okay.
Since we were in Canaveral.
Right.
People would break down off of Miami somewhere, and heaven forbid they'd send out the Dauntless. Well, you know, we don't want to get salt on the hull.
things never change.
I'm kidding. Sorry, Dauntless guys. I love you all. You took that hateful chief we had from us. It was more efficient to just, you know, head us out with a net and catch them.
I got
as
you.
They came drifting north.
Yeah.
So we were out more than we were in.
Right. Well, that hasn't changed at all. The schedule's changed quite a bit, but the sounds like the total time underway is about the same.
Yeah. So a lot of search and rescue, not much law enforcement back then. Of course, you know, 72, before things really got heated up.
Right. Right.
And one more thing on the Courageous. Let's see. We were out doing gunnery exercises when we had a working 3-inch. Dropped a big pyramid-shaped orange buoy in the water and go and head away from it, come back, do a Williamson. You guys know what that is, right?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. That's another thing that's never changed.
Right.
Yeah. And then we're at a 45-degree angle, I guess, ready to fire. And somebody says, hold fire. And the binoculars come out, and there's a helicopter, like, hovering over our buoy.
Ooh.
You know, we're in a firing order, you know, restricted zone. Why is there a helicopter? And out of the mist comes the HMS Ark Royal. It's got jump jets taking off. It's got helicopters taking off and landing. And the captain, I was on the bridge, captain says, get a hold of them. So I guess I picked the aircraft frequency, probably 243 kilohertz, whatever, megahertz. And they apologized, you know, very polite. So sorry, didn't mean to intrude on your little gunnery exercise. And off they went. Jump jets taking off, helicopters taking off and landing. So the captain says, screw it, let's just do a man overboard drill.
Totally changed the plan of the day.
Right.
Yeah, as long as we're doing Williamson turns, let's do another one. Drop another Oscar. And, of course, we got pretty good at it, which was very good. Because coming back from a rescue off of Georgia, we were really heavy quartering seas. Weather decks close, stay inside. One of the engine men breaks rules, goes topside to the quarter deck to grab a smoke.
I was going to say, the MK had to get a cigarette.
and we dip into a roller, and the wave just crashes, takes him over the stern, breaks loose a garbage can from its station. The garbage can rolls down to the stern, knocks the life buoy out of its holder into the sea with him.
Lucky?
More than lucky, quartermaster up on the bridge happens to go out on the bridge wing, happens to look aft at the same exact moment our guy goes over the stern.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. That's divine right there. So he calls out, he yells out on the one MC, man overboard, then this is not a drill. We pull the Williamson turn and get this poor guy before he gets, before he goes under. That was amazing. And the captain was so happy we got him back, as you can imagine, that he did not press any charges for him violating his order to stay inside.
Did you talk to the MK whenever he got back on board?
He was grateful.
Yeah.
Put it that way. He was remorseful that he had...
Did he quit smoking?
Yeah, he was on the top side, but grateful. It was just amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, so all this stuff occurred to me. I said, I got to make a book. And this is just the courageous part of the book. I'm only on there for like a year.
Right.
But it takes up half the book.
What about a radio station, Miami? What did you guys, was it just a repeater station?
No, we were live. We had, we ran 500 kilohertz, which was a Morse code emergency frequency, hailing frequency. We had radio teletype. We had an aircraft booth, which could really wear you out if there was an active case. And then we had voice on 2182.
2182.
Yep. And then a supervisor station. So we typically had three or four guys on watch, a chief, and then, you know, all the sports stuff, the ETs and so on.
It's funny, like 2182 is now like a stump the chump question.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Like, yeah, when you take a board, like, tell me the emergency frequency on HF.
We had somebody call us on a CB band, and the only transmitter we had was probably 30 or 40 watts, and I think we blew them up. But we worked them okay. And we used to, you know, on 500, you had to sit there with these, not headphones, but there were this Bakelite cans that sat on your temple, just forward over your ears. Otherwise, you would totally go deaf. And you sit there listening to Morse code, recording everything you heard, messing around with the Cubans and the Russians.
I kind of want to see you and Master Chief do a Morse code like contest one day. If we can ever get you guys in the same place, you and Patton, like at same place, same time, just see who still got it.
Right.
You know, who did stick with.
Who's going to judge it though? Because I'm not going to know what they're doing.
No, me either.
Yeah.
I mean, they can like tail each other or something. Yeah. Who is going to
do it? That's honor.
That's a great question.
No, I haven't forgotten it, but I'm not really good at it. I could probably do 20 words a minute now, and if I worked at it, and why would I? I could get up to like 30. But some of these E9s, they could sit there with their eyes like halfway closed, cigarette hanging out of their mouth, and listening to like 40 words a minute, and knowing what it was in their head. That was skill.
Yeah, I just remember SOS in case I ever like have to tap on the capsize hull and let people know I'm in there.
I might be able to do 40 words a day if I had to do.
That's better than me, I think.
Right. Well, no.
With the guide, though.
Right. With the guide. Yeah.
Yeah, we worked a couple of SOS calls, and that's when your hair stands up on end.
I'm sure.
The chief comes running into the booth. He's copying along with you to make sure they're good, and you just do it.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about that. So an SOS call over Morse code, you're just getting, I mean, do they repeat it three times? Is it like SOS, SOS, SOS?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you would think the other ships would shut up, but they don't.
What's the reply to, like, over Morse code if somebody transmits SOS?
You just acknowledge it. You call the ship's call name. This is, NMA, which was Radio Miami. We received your message, and you confirm the location, you confirm the actual condition, and Chief's on the phone with the rescue center. And sometimes, you know, they might not be even in our district, because at night some of those signals would travel with skip for hundreds of miles.
Yeah. Hmm.
But there was two quiet periods every hour, 15 after the hour for 3 minutes, and then 45 after the hour, when everybody's supposed to shut up, so you can hear a faint rescue, you know, a distress message.
Someone tells me people did not abide by that rule.
For the most part, but you know, if you're sitting there in distress, you're not going to wait for the quiet hour, really? Or the quiet minutes. So.
Right, half an hour might be a little too long to wait.
Yeah, exactly. So those were the fun days.
Mark, tell us about your book now. So let's talk about the first one, Always Ready, Coast Guard Sea Stories from the 70s. I think that's the one we've referenced the most, right?
Yep. Right.
Yeah, available on Amazon. And then you said that your grandfather, right?
My father.
Grandfather. You wrote Artifact, a B-24 crew, a female spy, and Churchill's deadly obsession.
Yeah, it's a mixture of fact and fiction. My dad was actually hit on the head with a piece of shrapnel moments after his co-pilot insisted that he put on his helmet on one mission. I don't know exactly what mission it was, but he had the piece of shrapnel. I've since given it to my son. So that's the artifact in question, that and his flight log.
Very cool.
That's awesome.
That is awesome. That's insanely awesome.
So, so the story is that this old guy who was a ball turret gunner in present day, he likes to hunt for World War II items and antique stores, and he finds one. He finds this piece of shrapnel in an old flight log in an antique store, and he recognizes it as from his captain, his pilot. And so the story goes from there.
That one. I know Bill looks forward to that
one. Yeah,
that one sounds really cool.
I love historical fiction. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, they end up on a spy mission to Ukraine. And there was an actual operation called Operation Frantic, in which the 8th Air Force wanted to do shuttle bombing. In other words, they'd fly from London or from England or Italy, bomb targets in Germany, Romania, and then just continue on to Ukraine, reload and refuel, and then bomb on the way back.
Solid plan, I think. I mean,
yeah.
Sounds like you're testing the limits of human endurance at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, let's just say it didn't work out as planned. And then the book goes in. There's a lot of fact in there mixed in with my fertile imagination.
Cool.
Your flair for the dramatic, if you will.
And the ending, there's a couple of surprise endings. So it's a good read. I like reading it myself.
Very cool. And then the newest one, Herb Lundy and the Magic Milk Truck. Explain that title to us.
I wish I could.
It sounds like, I'm trying to think of Hunter S. Thompson or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
right?
That's what it sounds like to me.
Fear and Loathing in the Milk Truck?
Yeah.
Something like that. It's set in my hometown in the late 1950s. So I'm a kid then, and I grew up there. And I just got this idea, and I really don't know where it came from, a couple of years ago, to do this story based in my hometown and have it a nostalgic piece, but also tie it in as a faith piece, where this guy who was struggling with his faith, who goes on this journey, who's given the opportunity to travel through time to different venues, different events, and experience, in the Bible, it's called the fruit of the Spirit, which is nine, I guess, attributes, you might say, that are undeniable. And if you're familiar with it, it's love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things, there is no law. So that's kind of a universal truth to me. And I felt that I wanted to express that through this character, Herb Lundy, who's a milkman. And the story goes from there, and it's kind of a, I guess it's a real homespun piece. It's probably, it's directed towards people I grew up with in Danbury and anybody who grew up there, but it's also got the time travel component, and it's also got the faith component. So it was a real challenge, I got to tell you, because it took me 2 years of stop and start before we could bring it home.
It's very cool, though, that you're cranking them out. I like any Coast Guard author that's out there. I think it's awesome that you guys are writing about the service and then continuing the trend. You know, just keep writing.
There's a guy. There's a former Coasties. Once a Coastie. His name is Jeff Thompson. He was writing a series of zombie stories
based
on the cutter Sassafras.
and SAS for us.
180. It's, yeah, out of Honolulu, I think, or the West Coast.
Yeah, it was in Hano, and then it was in Guam for a while.
He's got a wild imagination, and I'm not a zombie type guy or Day of the Dead at all, but I enjoyed his stuff.
Very cool.
Cool.
So I've got a Facebook page called Coast Guard Authors. And there's a few of us on there, and anybody who wants to hook up with that, just send in a member request. We'll get you in there.
Yeah, awesome. I would definitely push that out to everybody that's listening. Well, Mark, I'm going to
ask you. Anybody who's on the Courageous, I've got a Facebook page for that as well. CDC Facebook page, and we've got over 200 former crew members. And everybody's welcome aboard who served or a family member of someone who served.
You should let Bill in on that one. Just to offer like your love of the two tents.
You know what? The one I was on will probably be retired sooner or later, so.
Well, hey, back to the rule of the two tens.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know the rule? Do you remember the rule?
Yeah, I learned that rule from the same person you learned that rule from.
So any award you ever write, all you have to do is name 3 2-10s, and it's immediately approved. So, like, if you can tell somebody who's active, vigilant, courageous, done. Award's approved. You just got to snake them in there, like, at some point in time. Minimum of 3. But, hey, Mark, I'll ask you a final question for you. What were the most impactful lessons you think you took from your service in the Coast Guard that like still resonate with you today?
Well, you know, one of the things, the primary thing they taught us in radio school was security, safety, and speed. You know, and or security and speed. That can apply to a lot of things, and I've always was a just coming from all those diverse backgrounds in boot camp, and we had people from everywhere. I mean, and having us broken down to a common denominator, then built back up into a team in just, 8 or 9 weeks, that was pretty impressive as well. And our company commander was Bosun's mate, Chief John Cathy. He passed away a few years ago, but I was in contact with his family, and they found me through the book. I didn't mention him by name, but I had used a fictional name. But they said those characteristics had to be our Johnny, and they were right.
Very cool. And, yeah,
that's awesome.
Peg him right away.
In a lot of ways, he was kind of a second dad.
Yeah, and it's cool when somebody's got that kind of personality where, like, you could write about him decades later and people still know, like, oh, that's him. Yeah, that's right. Awesome.
It's like almost 50 years. It's so unique.
Yeah,
And I had a Master Chief radar man at Amver who was kind of like another father to me. And he spent so many years in the service, and his name was Joe Lambert. And he was, and he just gave me so much good advice and guidance, and I had a love for the man. And within a few couple of years after he retired, he passed, and I just it was such a kick in the gut. So, but I remember that's 40 years ago. I mean, it's still with me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and some of the guys from the Courageous I'm in contact with, I see them every now and then, and that's very rewarding as well. These things just don't go away.
I think it's cool, man.
Never be as close to, other than your family, you'll never be as close to anybody as the guys you served with, especially like if you've been underway and had that, cut off from the rest of the world experience.
Yeah, you're depending on each other. It's like, oh my God, what are we doing here?
Please brush your teeth because your breath smells
right.
Bad. That, yeah.
Right. Yeah. I always said it was like living at summer camp.
Right. Right. That's exactly what it's like.
Yeah, we were up to quite a few hijinks, and the subtitle on the Coast Guard book is Radios, Rescues, and Rowdiness.
Yep,
that's fair enough. Yeah,
sounds not necessarily in that order.
I love it. Well, hey, Mark, we really appreciate your time today. Thanks for sharing your sea stories with us, and thank you for your service.
Yeah, Mark, thank you very much. Always good to talk to you. Thank you.
We enjoyed it. All right. Also, I've got a 2-10 crew T-shirt. If it's your size, let me know.
Awesome. We'll throw it on the wall, and then that will frame that thing.
Absolutely.
I'm going to send you the book, and I'll send you a shirt.
Great. Hey, great. Mark, thanks, really appreciate it again.
Take care.
You too.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.